Welcome once again to another fantastic episode of the Business Creators Radio Show. We help business creators like you win at the game of business and marketing so you can thrive from your intersection of your brilliance and your passion and make a difference for your community, market, and audience. Please take a moment and visit our website, www.businesscreatorsradioshow.com. You'll find hundreds of episodes covering a breadth and depth of topics relevant to you as a business creator, and links to subscribe via your favorite network so you get fresh episodes delivered straight to you. And now, here's today's episode. Let's get started.
My name is Adam Homey. I am your host, and I am honored once again by your wise decision to tune in and invest in yourself today. The Business Creators Radio Show is not one of those podcasts that has a $25,000 Hollywood quality studio with soundproof walls. In fact, it's a lovely morning here in Las Vegas. I actually just logged in to start my day, and I'm sitting out here on my laptop on my balcony with my sumptuous view of a few of the rooftops of the strip way off in the corner there. And we're about to have a great conversation here about something that we should come to expect as entrepreneurs, as business leaders, as CEOs, as managers, as anybody who has a leadership position over people, processes, and events, which is the unexpected. So we're going to be, among other things, discovering 9 tips for navigating the inevitable unexpected, and we're going to learn these secrets from a biotech CEO. Our avid listeners know that sometimes I tell you to look into places where people aren't asking to find the answers to the questions you haven't thought to ask yet. And this may actually be one of those things for me. Now, when I saw this title, I'm thinking, goodness gracious, I need this for myself because I've been dealing with a lot of unexpected, particularly in the past 6 months. It's been freaking crazy. But I think that our listeners, those of you who are tuning in today, those of you who are listening to it later on, are going to love this. And you are really going to enjoy our guests. I've had a brief chat with him so far, and I'm really excited about him. His name is Stan Rose. So he has a PhD. He's an MIT biologist turned life sciences executive, an entrepreneur who has created and led multiple businesses in the emerging fields of DNA analysis and genomics. After several successful ventures, he was suddenly diagnosed with a life-threatening genetic disease, and some of the same technologies he helped bring to the clinic became critical to his own survival. So following a kidney transplant, he's continued to contribute to science and medicine. His firm, Rose Ventures Incorporated, works with early-stage companies developing innovative, high-impact life science products and services. And he has a book out. It's a new book. It's called Can't Tame a Mongoose, Memoir of a Genomics Entrepreneur. And I really hope I'm pronouncing that name right. Stan Rose, come on in. Weather's fine.
Hi, Adam. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here, and welcome to listeners.
Okay, well, as you know, it's actually the very beginning of my day, so am I pronouncing that right, genomics?
Genomics is fine, yes.
Genomics, all right, I was real close. All right, cool. Yeah. So I read off your bio, though. It's so impressive. I'm not sure I'm worthy to be here, and this is my show. And we touched a little bit on your story, but what I'd like to do here before we dive in, I know we have a lot of talking points here, and we're going to get through as many as we can, as we have just sort of a nice mastermind chat, as our listeners know, is I want to turn it over to you first. And in your own words, tell us a bit, you know, go beyond the bio, go behind the tab, as they say, and tell us a bit about your journey and what's brought you to where you are today, serving business sure. creators from your intersection of your brilliance and your passion.
Yeah. It was a long and winding road.
Yeah.
I'll try and give you the relatively short version. Let's see. I guess part of the reason it was long and winding road is that one of my challenges in life is that I've always been interested in too many different things.
Okay.
And as a consequence, when I went to college, I didn't really, I thought I knew what I wanted to study, but I didn't. And, you know, in retrospect, you know, the 4 years that I spent as an undergraduate at Cornell were all, it was a period of discovery. And pretty late in the process, I came to the conclusion that what really fascinated me was biology. Let's see, by the time I graduated, I wound up actually with a degree in psychology, primarily because that was the only field I had enough credits in to get a degree. I didn't have enough biology credits yet because I'd discovered that late. So I wound up thinking about becoming a graduate student, but I knew I needed to beef up my resume a little bit in order to do that. So I spent a year working in the psychobiology laboratory at Harvard Medical School. And during that period, very quickly came to the conclusion that biological research was what I wanted to do. And that in order to be able to design experiments that I thought of myself, as opposed to carrying out experiments that others had thought of, I needed a PhD. So right. Very naively, in retrospect, I applied to two schools, MIT and Harvard. I wound up getting an interview pretty early at MIT and was told sort of point blank that if I just filled out the application form, I would get in. So I never pursued the other one. Subsequently wound up in the graduate program in biology at MIT. And this was in the late 70s, early 80s. So I enrolled in September of 79.
Right.
So right around that period of time, if you talk to most people pursuing a career in biology and academics, their view was that if you couldn't get a tenured position as a professor somewhere, you were a failure. And in particular, if you decided to go get involved in industry, you were a real loser. And so that was sort of the conventional wisdom and the culture in which I was sort of growing up in. In the midst of all this, the biotechnology industry came roaring into being. And all of a sudden, I saw all of my professors either founding or joining as advisors biotechnology companies. And so this whole notion of industry being, you know, sort of the burial place of dead PhDs was, you know, turned on its head when some of the most famous professors at one of the most prestigious institutions in the field were all getting involved with companies. So I wanted to understand a bit more about, you know, why was this happening? And I spoke to one very prominent professor in particular, David Botstein. You know, he said to me, well, here's the challenge, Stan. You know, if I keep doing what I've been doing and applying for NIH grants, then maybe I get, you know, I'm lucky I get $1 million, $2 million, and I kind of inch the ball a little further up the field in terms of what I'm trying to accomplish in terms of, you know, enhancing understanding of some aspect of biology. But if I join a company, I might have a research budget of $20 or $30 million. And with that kind of funding, I can take on really meaningful problems. And beyond that, the company, the whole purpose of the company is to not just advance knowledge, but it's to actually impact people's lives. And to me, that was really compelling and it changed my whole view. And so I decided to, while I was at MIT, to take advantage of the fact that the Sloan School of Management was there. And I wound up crafting a minor in management and trying to learn what I could about the world of business while I was simultaneously working on my PhD in biology. So by the time I graduated, I knew that I did not want to stay in academia, that I want to get involved in this, you know, really exciting new industry that was emerging. And from there, I'd say sort of the rest is history. I wrote a book about it, Can't Tame a Mongoose. And at least that's part of what it's about. It's one of probably three stories that run in parallel. But
Stan, if I could interject real quickly, and I don't want to interrupt your flow, but you're actually touching on my first question. I want our listeners to capture this. What's up with the mongoose, man?
The mongoose, yes. Yeah. Let's see. I spent over a decade living in the Virgin Islands.
Okay.
At some point, I was driving with a friend of mine who was born on the island of Dominica.
Yep.
We were talking about local politics and certain politician that was very, I would say, hard-headed. Just didn't matter what was going on. You could not shake him from, the thing he wanted to talk about and the goals he wanted to achieve. And they weren't things that we necessarily agreed with. And so anyway, at one point, my friend, whose name is Jeff, said to me something to the effect of, well, you know what they say, my friend, can't tame a mongoose. And I thought about it for a moment, and the first thing that came to mind was, there's some people who, you can't change their nature. It's not a good use of your time to even try, so just don't even worry about it. But as I thought more about it, I also realized there's a very positive interpretation of this saying, and that is the fact that just like a mongoose, by the way, mongoose, for those who don't know, is an animal that's native to Africa and certain parts of Asia. They prey on snakes and rodents. They were introduced into the Caribbean in order to help deal with that problem when the first settlers or colonists came into that part of the world. Shouldn't say settlers. The first colonists came from Europe by way of Africa. In any event, I thought it had a very positive connotation, or could, in that just like a mongoose can't be stopped from getting its prey, achieving its mission, a good entrepreneur also has similar characteristics. They're focused on the mission at hand. They are internally driven, highly motivated, no matter what's thrown in their tracks. They're very creative. They're very resilient. They're very persistent. It's virtually impossible to stop them from achieving their goals. And so that's where I came up with the name. And in particular, once I settled on a theme for the book that I wanted to write, it just became even more relevant.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. See, and folks have asked me, why is the first question always the one about tell us your story in your own words, particularly for the guests who tell a bit of the story in their bio? It's just magic. And I've been hosting this show for going on 12 years. And we introduced that question, I think, somewhere around year two or year three. And we get these stories that just go so much further than the bio. And sometimes it's actually almost a completely different story. But just within everything you shared there, there were a number of different teaching points and a couple aha moments and a few places where I nodded and I said, yep, same, Stan, same. Like going to college and then being in your final semester and discovering that thing you've been studying for the whole time is the last thing you'd ever want to flip and do in your life. I mean, I've been there.
It happens.
So just to that story very briefly is my childhood dream was to be president of the United States. I don't know why. And just to put a context on it, today I want to be the person whose money decides who the president's going to be. I think there's more power in that. But you mentioned politics on the island of Dominica, which I actually know where that is. I haven't been there, but I know where it is. I'm mentioning that I'd rather own the president. But here's the thing. I think another thing is my father had studied to be an attorney and then didn't complete his studies. I'm going to be a lawyer. Went to college. My undergrad degree was political science. And the very last semester, And it was actually an extra semester I added on because I started kind of young and I just needed more time to be a Penn State student, actually old enough to go to bars, you mean, you know, obviously. And although the official reason was I had an opportunity to do a TA gig that final semester that wouldn't have been available if I hadn't stuck around an extra semester. Anyway, so we're in the ninth semester of my 4-year career at Penn State, and we're about 6 weeks away from graduation. And I'm already thinking ahead to the LSATs, and I'm thinking about how as soon as this semester is off, I'm actually going to go get some basic job for 6 months, just so I have a lot of time to prepare for the LSAT and just chill for a while before I dive into something big. So, so all that was in progress too. I attend this symposium taught by that was led by one of the adjunct professors at the Dickinson School of Law, which is the law school that is paired with Penn State. And this guy was charismatic. He was mesmerizing. He was antagonizing. He was exhilarating. And man, could he tell you stories about the reality of life as a corporate attorney. In fact, at first I'm thinking, you know what? Maybe I should just go to Dickinson so I can have this guy's class. That's how excited I was about him. By the time I was done listening to him, I said, there's no freaking way in my life I'm going to be a lawyer. This is not me.
So imagine
going through all that and then saying, okay, so I just graduated college. Now what?
Right.
Well, I mean, yeah, I did disclose to you that I didn't have any immediate plans to go get some big job. In fact, I was, most of my job networking that time is I had established communications with a couple temp agencies. I was going to find something just for this first 6 months because I was going to sort of chill back, prepare for the LSATs. And then after I got through the LSATs, then I would go look for a job commensurate with my degree. I thought I might even travel a little bit. Who knows? But anyway, the point being is we do find ourselves in those situations. And it's also interesting that I found my political science degree very valuable when I got into online marketing. It made me a better writer and a better communicator.
Because
what is political science? It's understanding human behavior and conducting predictive analysis on how people will take actions based on data you have on them. And that's a critical skill if you're trying to sell or market anything.
The impact of unexpected events on one's life.
That's where I want to go. See, you're a genius level today, Stan. I know you're a PhD and I just have an MBA, but you are definitely at my wavelength, proving your genius level, because that was my next question. What is inevitable unexpected events? I mean, that sounds like a paradox, but you say it's not. So what's up with that?
No, it's not. Well, there are two things up with it. I was trying to distinguish what I'm talking about from black swan events, which have gotten a lot of coverage over the last decade or so, thanks to Nassim Nicholas Taleb's book, which I think is fantastic, and I love the thought shared there. But those are rare, high impact, outlier events. And that's not what I'm talking about at all. Those definitely happen and they have a big impact. What I'm talking about are things that happen with much higher frequency. So especially since I started writing this book, so let's say over the last couple of years, I have yet to meet a CEO who, when I ask them the question, as you've been building your business, have you ever encountered a challenge or an opportunity that you absolutely never expected, never thought about previously? And if you didn't come up with a solution to the challenge, or if you didn't decide whether or not to change directions and pursue the opportunity, your business likely would have failed. And every one of them says, absolutely, it leads into one or multiple stories. My point is, these Dan, things happen to everybody.
I know. Yeah, let me just say it. I mentioned at the beginning of our conversation that I actually woke up just in time to do our interview. This is the first thing I'm doing today. I haven't even gotten to my email yet, but just off a casual glance on it on my phone while I was having my cup of hot tea before I logged into Zoom to get recording on this, I happen to know that I have like two or three of those waiting in my email.
Yes. Right. So I won't go as far as to say that they're going to hit you daily, but certainly, you know, here's sort of also the background perspective. So over a period of 5 years, on the order of 90% of technology-based businesses do not survive. So these are businesses that are generally started by intelligent people who at least have convinced themselves that they have good ideas. Uh-huh. They put together some kind of a business plan, you know, whether that plan is, you know, a set of bullet points in the back of a napkin or, you know, a one-page outline or a 10-page PowerPoint or a 50-page document, whatever it is, you know, they've given it some thought. They've either decided to put their own money into it or they've gone out and gotten external investors. If they've gotten external investors, then those guys have definitely done their due diligence and they've vetted the plans. Maybe the plans have been modified. By the time they put their money in, they're pretty convinced that they like the opportunity, they like the founder, and they think they thought through the plan well enough that it's going to succeed. And yet 90% of them fail. And certainly when they think of all the things they could encounter along the way, they unquestionably think about everything they teach you in business school about why new ventures fail. And there's a lot of documentation about lack of product market fit or, you know, R&D challenges or being able to appropriately scale or, you know, I mean, it goes on and on, you know, intellectual property issues. So, you know, it's relatively easy in retrospect to look at 1,000 businesses that failed and catalog what were the reasons they failed and then teach a course about why do businesses fail. But what's not so easy is if you've developed a plan and then in real time, something comes up that you hadn't planned on, and now you have to react to it. And it could be, often is, in the category of one of the reasons that people fail, or the companies fail, but it's not something you ever thought about. It's not something, it's just not something you planned on in advance. And so then the ability of the CEO and their team to effectively respond in that, what I call moment of truth, really distinguishes those from, you know, those who are likely to sort of navigate past that situation, hopefully to successful outcome, versus those who can't and wind up, failing. So that's part one. That's really, you know, I think it, as I, by the way, I didn't start writing this book with all this in mind as part of the story, but as I wrote enough stories about my experience in business, all of a sudden I had this epiphany about this general issue around success and failure of businesses that I thought was underappreciated and decided I wanted to make, you know, wanted to make that the theme of my book. But beyond that, I wanted to talk about the strategies, values, and approaches that I've used over time that I honestly believe enhance the likelihood that when you encounter an unexpected event, you'll be able to successfully navigate past it. And so that's really the essence of the book. And I also didn't want to write I didn't want to write a how-to guide. I didn't want to tell people, you know, this is how to build a successful business and follow these instructions and you will succeed, because I don't believe it. And I don't believe that there is any single formula to success. And I don't believe there's any way to avoid these unexpected events. And again, I'm not guaranteeing that if you practice the things that I suggest, that you will be successful. I mean, it's just like any other skill. Some people are really good at it and some people aren't. And so,
yeah,
you know, so there's that too. But I really do believe that that if you incorporate, again, certain strategies, values, approaches into your sort of practice, just make it a practice. I think about like yoga, quite frankly, or anything else anyone does to improve their physical or mental health on a regular basis. If these are things that you follow, then I think they'll give you strategic advantage when you encounter those events.
Yeah, I think that you you make this, you summarize this all pretty interestingly. And I see what I got out of the phrase originally before you described it is the idea of inevitable unexpected events. It goes back to two sayings that I tend to live by, and as much as I embrace them, I sometimes get blindsided by them, even when I think I've anticipated them. One of which is a phrase that many of us have heard, which is that God draws straight with crooked lines. And another is that God answers all prayers, but sometimes he says no. And when he does, it's because he wants you to see a bigger picture.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I buy all that.
Yeah. Yeah. There are many things I prayed for that I've been denied. And I think that a lot of people can agree, regardless of, you know, what type of faith they have, or if they have a faith, whether they believe in a God, whether they believe in a spirit or a universal energy or whatever it is, that they pray for it, they summon it, they manifest it, and it doesn't always work out. I mean, when I first studied law of attraction many, many years ago, before I really got into it, and I was very surface level with it, I was still with the trope that, oh, that law of attraction, isn't that that thing where you open up all your windows and you sit in your couch in the lotus position and stretch out your arms and money will just start flying through the window? And I'm going to tell you, Stan, I tried that. And the reason is because I kept hearing about sitting on the couch in a lotus position with your windows open and stretching out your arms and money flowing in. I didn't want to be the idiot who dismissed it and then only to find out it was real and somebody else got the money.
Yes. Well, I absolutely believe in being open-minded and creative.
Yeah. So let's bring this to practical terms. I know you gave me so many talking points, and I'm actually to a degree combining some of these so we get as much from you as possible, because I know you have a lot to share. You described inevitable unexpected events in theory and definition, but do you have any recent instances that you might have seen of maybe a well-known firm or an entrepreneur who has faced this type of inevitable unexpected event, and how did it go?
Well, I think more, I spend most time thinking about the life sciences. It's not that I don't pay attention to what happens in other industries. I can probably give you the best examples off my head in the life sciences. But actually I'll just talk about a phenomenon that's happened broadly without even pointing to one specific company. Over the last 2 years, I would say, certainly since the middle of 2021, so 2.5 years, the market got very sort of over-enthusiastic in terms of valuations and willingness to invest in wild and crazy ideas. I think people with big personalities who could tell good stories, who had accomplished things, who were representing those ideas. And now there's been a fairly major correction. And as a consequence, something like 50% of the companies that, raised money at billion-dollar valuations in 2021 have seen their valuations drop between 50 and 90% during that period of time. And so now, you know, they're all sitting there either laying people off. They certainly never expected when they raised that money to see their valuations plummet that dramatically during that short period of time. So, you know, point to whichever company you want and how they dealt with that situation. You know, quite frankly, if they raised enough money and made enough progress in that short period of time, they probably did pretty well. And that speaks to a couple of, you know, I think the approaches that I discussed in terms of, you know, moving rapidly and, you know, and always accumulating resources and, you know, and always, you know, building relationships. And actually, when I think about starting any team, it's the kind of the, or any business, it's really the, some of the most fundamental things are, you know, do you have the right idea? Do you have the right people? Do you understand the customers and have close relationships with them? And are you willing to be adaptable? You know, often people, actually, I think we've touched on this a couple of times already in this conversation, but people start with, you know, one idea, think it's the direction that they want or ought to go, and then something comes up that changes their mind. So, you know, I'd rather talk about it that way than, I mean, I can, as I said, like in the life science business, for example, in the, let's see, in the mid 90s, I worked for a company called Applied Biosystems. Among other things, that company was famous for basically having been the first major supplier of systems for sequencing DNA. They basically, you know, their systems fueled the Human Genome Project. At some point in time in, you know, by the late 90s, they probably had 90% market share. What they never saw coming was a new technology that wound up being commercialized by a company called Illumina that, you know, is very well known today. And today is the dominant player with similar market share in DNA sequencing. And Applied Biosystems still sells, I believe, on the order of several hundred million dollars of product a year, but they're a very small player compared to Illumina. So,
yeah,
you know, how do you be that dominant a player in a field with the level of connections they had and the customer relationships and not see this technology coming or be able to respond to it in any effective way? Yet it happens. So I mean, I can give you many other examples, but there's just the kind of thing I'm talking about. Something takes you completely by surprise. If, you know, obviously, if they had thought or even imagined of the approach that Illumina took, they would have taken it.
Right.
So.
Oh, yeah.
Missed opportunity.
All right. So these inevitable unexpected events. Now, what can we do to avoid them?
I don't believe you can avoid them.
All right.
I think it's more about how you respond to them.
Okay.
I don't think it's about avoiding them. And I won't go through all of the things, but what, you know, I think we've spoken a bit about, you know, we were talking about the mongoose and its sort of characteristics. There's a certain approach to operating your business. We've already talked about that. So I'm going to sort of leave those things out. But in developing this practice I talk about, I think a couple of the key things are, first of all, to always be developing relationships. So the notion of networking, you know, that's something that's been discussed for a long time and advocated. And I have a funny story about LinkedIn. Well, I'll tell you a short version was that when LinkedIn, you know, first came out, somebody told me about it. I tried it out and I had such a bad experience with it that I just decided it was worthless. And beyond that, I swore that I would never use that platform. And I held on to that for over 10 years, about a year and a half ago at a point where I no longer needed access to that platform. I just came to the realization they had changed their whole approach and had just become an institution in terms of professional networking. And if you weren't using LinkedIn, you were a fool. I gave in and created an account. But anyway, beyond the value of networking, that's generally, and it's even with LinkedIn, it's in a very directed fashion. But what I think is especially important is just to always be listening to people and be developing relationships in a non-directed fashion. And I'm not saying to avoid kind of the LinkedIn directed networking type thing. You absolutely need to pursue that. But you never know in advance the type of expertise that you might need access to, or the type of network that you may need to tap into at the time that you run into a problem that you never anticipated. And, you know, what happens if, I don't know, if you have some sort of a legal issue pops up in an area that is not mainstream to your business, but if you don't comply, you're out of business. And then suppose you were sitting on a plane one day and the guy sitting next to you happened to be an expert in that area.
Right.
And you exchange contact information. It's, you know, it's things like that. So I think it's, I again have many examples of times where I've been fortunate, to have known somebody that I could call on when I ran into a challenge or when I saw an opportunity. For example, I was very, very fortunate over the course of my career to have an opportunity to travel all over the world before I started my first startup business. So early on, actually, in that very first business, one of the things that we did to finance the business was we reached out to a Japanese contact that I knew, understanding that the little tiny company we were starting in Boston was years away, if ever, from selling products in Japan. It's really complicated for anybody to sell in Japan if you don't have an existing network there, which generally means a Japanese distribution company. But I had a great relationship with somebody who ran one of those businesses by virtue of the fact that I'd spent a lot of time in Japan years earlier. And so I contacted them. And even though, you know, we had crude prototypes of our first product, they took a look at what we were working on. They looked at the people involved. They looked at the idea. And they decided that they wanted to have access to it early, and they were willing to pay for that. And so we had a source of non-dilutive financing that was substantial early on. What did we give up? We gave up rights to Japan. In the big picture, it was nothing. So again, I can give you sort of many examples, but relationships. But yeah, we've only spoken about relationships, constantly accumulating resources. By resources, I certainly mean money. I've never met a CEO, I should say never, but it's very, very rare that you may meet a CEO who will tell you that in their very first financing, they raised enough money and they never needed more. Or that each time along the way, they raised money four or five times, but they always raised enough. And they never had a stressful situation where, oh, oops, I didn't raise enough money the last time around, and maybe I need more.
Oh, you're a funny guy.
And then the other side of it is also true. You meet so many people who haven't been down this path who are worried about dilution, and they just don't want to raise more money because they're convinced that they're going to be worth so much more later. And I don't want to sell stock now. And it's just usually very short-sighted. Accumulating resources. And again, resources doesn't just have to be money. Technological expertise, specialized equipment, people. Just if you have an opportunity to bring an all-star onto your team, do it. I have another example there where the last company where I was CEO, we were developing a diagnostics product. One of the leading chief medical officers in the field was retiring from a job at a large company, large pharmaceutical company, because they had changed their strategic direction and he just wasn't interested in pursuing it anymore. I heard about this, went to meet him at O'Hare because we lived in different places. So we picked a place in between. So we met in the airport the afternoon after he had turned in his resignation and spent 3 hours chatting. Both went our separate ways. He agreed to join us in the little field that we were focused on. This was a major event. We had convinced, I think easily the most prominent chief medical officer in the field to come join us. You get off, those opportunities don't come along very often and you got to take advantage of them. So
yeah.
The third thing I'll talk about, and then I'll move on to other things. I think is always think about options. So I'm really big on being focused and mission driven. But in doing so, I think it's really important that you think about multiple approaches to achieving your goal, because it could be that certainly the path that you choose is the one that you think is most likely to bear fruit, but something might come up that blocks it. And so having two or three other ways to approach your goal is better than just giving up. Okay. And and the other thing I would say is better than just giving up is also thinking all the time, what if I'm just permanently blocked? What if there's just no way I can do what I wanted to do? Is there some other way that I can apply what I've created in a way that will ultimately be of value to a group of customers that I understand? Often people don't wind up thinking about these things until they're in the position where they're confronted with the challenge. And at that point, your time is really limited. Your investors and your board are not going to give you much rope. And, so if you've thought about it in advance, it's going to be to your advantage. And that's one of the reasons that I believe also that, plans are worthwhile. They're very important, but they need to be reviewed regularly and more than once a year. It's sort of I think the whole team ought to understand the plan, first of all, because kind of an obstacle can come from any direction. As a group, you ought to review and modify your plans as needed, like at least on a quarterly basis.
Right.
Really should be a living document. So I'll leave it at that. But those are the types of things that I discuss.
Well, I think that, it's great to have an overall plan or an overall trajectory of where you're headed. But, and you can do it however you want. As you mentioned, everything from the bullet points on a cocktail napkin to actually going on a team retreat and developing all these things is sort of some sort of kumbaya session that ends in everybody reviewing and critiquing a PowerPoint that we're all going to live by forever. And about a day after you get started on that, there'll be some unanticipated change in the marketplace or the technology or society, just name it, that is really nothing you could have predicted. And it's also nothing you can control. And in order to potentially thrive in that situation, it's going to be necessary for you to react to it or pivot, or as the case may be. So go ahead.
Let me give you one other example, because this is probably the most challenging one I ever faced. There's almost anyone who's built a business has seen contracts that refer to acts of God. And it'll talk about things like earthquakes and hurricanes and tornadoes and volcanoes and things like that. And I, by the way, been through a major earthquake with a business and seen the impact. But I don't know how many people have had the experience of co-founding a business with a couple of partners. One of them winds up in the role of chief scientific officer, And at a critical point in your technological development, he's diagnosed with cancer. And a few months later, he's no longer alive.
Right.
What do you do in that situation? And that's probably the most challenging thing I've ever faced. And there, you know, if you have the right team and the right advisors and the right board, and you're all, you know, your goals are aligned, you have a common vision, you have good communication skills, I think about it as a basketball team. A guy gets injured, he can't play, he's out for the season. It's next man up. Everybody else has to figure out how to work as a team, fill in the void, and move forward. And it's a very hard thing to do because these are people who are, you know, they're your friends. They're human beings. And it's, you know, it's a time, it's an incredibly stressful time, but you need to figure out, you know, how to persevere anyway. It's about resilience. So.
Yeah. Certainly. So, what would you say of, I mean, we've covered a lot of things, but if you were to pick number one, whether it's something you've already said or something we haven't covered yet, what do you say is the entrepreneur's most common and potentially damaging blind spot?
Yeah,
pick one.
Yeah, that's actually easy. It's optimism.
Okay.
I think that anyone who starts a business, especially a technology-based business, knowing that 9 out of 10 are not going to be around in 5 years, you have to be an optimist by nature. You have to be personally driven, internally driven. You have to be a true believer. And, you know, you need to convince the others that are working with you to believe in your vision. But that can be your biggest blind spot too. Especially as you start to have some success, you know, you really want, you know, you want it. You want it really bad. And so when something comes up you never expected, you know, denial can kick in. Or, you know, you can develop a degree of arrogance or, yeah, it's just this blinding optimism that, oh, it'll all work out, or that's not really that big a problem. Let, you know, we don't have to worry about it. Or if we can just patch it up long enough, maybe the guys investing in the next round won't see it, and and we'll figure it out later. I've seen lots of excuses, but I think that's it. I think it's over optimism, you know, can be a real problem.
Right. Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, without some sort of optimism, you're not going to get very far with it. But at the same time, it can also be extremely what have you. Like, with the dynamics with some of my consulting clients, I will, as much as possible, project the opposite energy that they are sharing. And part of it's the whole devil's advocate thing, and part of it is also making sure that they have balance. So, for example, if they're like all giddy or something and they're sure that this thing that they've developed or conceived is going to be extremely successful, or they've just developed the most amazing thing ever that absolutely cannot fail, I'm going to go into an area of extreme pessimism and paranoia.
Yeah. Yeah.
And essentially make them prove it. Now, if they go into this place of, shall we say, that thing where they're afraid to do anything because of, you know, what are the possible impacts, I'll go into the whole carpe diem space. And I think that's valuable to everybody involved, because if you don't have that juxtaposition and you don't have those energies balancing each other, you're going to probably ultimately lose because you're not going to have a balanced vision.
Exactly. I think you have to have a combination of, you know, optimism and drive, but at the same time, you have to be well-grounded in realism. And, You know, and I think you need to always bear in mind that, you know, the world of life is complex.
Yeah.
And there just are things, there always are things that we don't know, we don't understand, we couldn't possibly expect. And that's why I just, you know, that's why I believe so strongly in this practice, as I call it, that hopefully will enable you to, you know, to do well, to make the right decisions when you're confronted with these things.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I certainly agree with that. So with the change of with the pace of change and the pace of growth today, what impact do these things have in terms of the so-called usual strategies to scale a new company? And the reason I'm asking this question, aside from the fact that it was in your proposed talking points, is that for everybody that tells me I need to build a funnel for my business, there's somebody that's telling me the funnels are dead. For everybody that tells me that email marketing is dead, there are those that tell me that they sent one email and made $98,000 off of it. My simple answer for a lot of these things is that there are many different ways you can approach whatever it is you're looking to achieve. You don't have to do everything. You actually can't possibly do everything, but you have options of deciding, you have options of deciding what works best for you. I'll give you an example, the Business Creators Radio Show. When you logged in for our conversation, what was the very first thing I said?
I honestly don't remember anymore other than good day.
Actually, before I even said good day, what was the very first thing I said?
I honestly do not remember.
Oh, I asked you to turn your camera off and told you to do whatever you want.
That's
so
right.
I've had this podcast that we're on for almost 12 years now. It's always been audio only, and it always will be. And I get every so often, and sometimes this comes from the guests, they think they're going to advise me, never minding that launching podcasts is what my business does, that we really need to have video because it'll be more engaging and more people will tune in. And I say, thank you so much, but whatever. But you know the main reason that we're an audio-only format and why we don't do video?
Why?
I just don't want to.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, and that actually kind of speaks to my point, is that you don't have to do everything, and you don't have to do something just because somebody said if you don't do this, you're not really in business. Well, the fact is, you really are in business, regardless of what somebody says, and you have the right and the ability to choose what that's going to be. So with all of that, what would be the approach that you would recommend people take?
Well, I sort of have two answers. I have the one I thought about in advance, but you brought up a big one that reminded me of something else. So virtually every business that I've been involved with in the beginning, and this could just be, my sample, who knows? It could be more general, but I think it certainly applies to any company, any technology-based company that has what I'll call a platform. And by that, I mean sort of a technology that could be applied in any area or in a wide range of areas. Invariably, they try to present a story of we're going to solve everything or way too many things. Right. And they think, and if again, we go back to something we discussed earlier, a couple of years ago, there was good reception in the venture capital community for platform ideas where we can put a ton of money to work trying to address a whole bunch of different things. But nowadays, that's not the case. And I've always felt that you were much better off if you could focus quickly And that comes to my second part, which is the importance of speed. And this is something, I don't think this has ever changed, but I think it's become more important as the market has changed. And if you can figure out ways to move faster from one stage to the next, and, you know, part of that, sometimes that means, you know, if you're building a product or a service, it's a process. If you can do something in the way of rapid prototyping, there's this whole notion of minimum viable product has been around for a decade or so now. It's sort of that notion, but in a lot of different ways. Thinking how to be capital efficient. There was a period of time where that was in vogue, then it wasn't in vogue. You know, again, people were thinking about raising more money, and it was better to throw a lot of money at things and convince investors that that was a better way. I've just always felt that moving fast, developing rapid prototypes for minimum viable products, demonstrating that there were groups of key opinion leaders in a relevant marketplace or segment of the market that really cared and you know, became sort of devoted missionaries for what you were doing, that was critical, that you know, that performing small scale studies, and not too small, but just big enough to get published, big enough to, you know, convince people who weren't among those sort of those early adopters that this is real and it's going to have real benefits for me, you know, as it's further developed. So it's, you know, gaining early traction with customers. I think as you get to the point that you're now commercializing, it's about leveraging partnerships. You don't have to build all the infrastructure yourself.
Right.
There's plenty of other companies out there that have it all built. And, you know, there's some art to negotiation in terms of what, you know, what do you give up in exchange for access to, you know, to some phenomenal capability that they've already developed. But again, speed is incredibly important and becoming more important because the world is changing faster. It just is. Yeah, that's what I wanted to say.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's probably a pretty good place for our listeners to have us end, because that gives them a great thing to sort of sit back and ponder for the next few minutes before they move on to their next thing. So what I'd like to do now as we wrap up is to extend an invitation on your behalf to our listeners, and that is to visit your website, which is www.roseventures.net. That's www.roseventures.net. And when you go there, you can discover a lot about Stan Rose. You can see some of his work, his blog, and what's most important, I think, in the short term, is I encourage everybody, go to the homepage of the website, scroll down a little bit, and you will see the opportunity to claim your copy of Stan's book, which is basically the compendium of what we've been touching on today. And it's called Can't Tame a Mongoose, Memoirs of a Genomics Entrepreneur. So you heard the story of the mongoose and why the mongoose is important to what we're talking about when it comes to all of these inevitable, unexpected events. So read the book, get the treatise, and discover what's going on with that. That's www.roseventures.net. I may have to go snag a copy for me off Amazon. So with that, Stan Rose, thank you so much for being with us today. It's been an honor, and believe me, an education.
Adam, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. It's really been a pleasure speaking. And thanks to all the listeners out there. This has been a lot of fun, and I hope you enjoy the book.
We trust you enjoyed today's episode of the Business Creators Radio Show. Check out our previous and upcoming episodes on our website at www.businesscreatorsradioshow.com. While you're there, be sure to subscribe via your favorite network so you get fresh episodes delivered straight to you. Until next time, have a great day. Take care.